The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, transitioning biopharmaceutical drugs, which must be infused in the bloodstream, into easy-to-take pills. We talk about one Darwinian approach. Then shock, a devastating condition which does far more damage than we realize, and one company's approach to intervening early. Biopharmaceutical drugs, the so-called biologics, are large molecules. As a result, patients must go to infusion centers to infuse them directly. I asked Dr. Kevin Jadis, president and CEO of DICE Molecules, why can't we just put them in a pill?
That's a good question. So there are a couple of different reasons. The first is that the large molecules are proteins, and your body's sort of set up that if you ingest proteins orally, your stomach digests them and turns them into nutrients for you.
All kinds of things.
Yeah, all kinds of nice things.
Before it gets to your
None of which are actually productive drugs in your system. So they get digested. But even if you could get them through the stomach, there's another problem that has to do with just the sheer physical size of them. They can't permeate their way across the various barriers in the intestinal tract and make their way into the bloodstream. Uh-huh. So if you think about it, your body is set up to be very careful about what it lets into the bloodstream, right? And you don't, you know, you want to have a process going on in your gut where when you eat things, you know, you digest them into things you want, and those things are transported across or diffused across, but not everything gets across. A lot of it gets out as waste. So there's just not a good process for getting those things through the gut and into your bloodstream. Ergo, you have to be treated via an infusion center or something like that.
And then when they're small and you make pills out of them, that's what we call, was it medicinal chemistry? If they're small enough, we can actually make it a pill.
Yeah, that's right. The nomenclature that's jargon in the industry is, you know, large molecules and small molecules. And it really just breaks down to small molecules are small enough entities and stable enough entities that they can go through your gut and pass into your bloodstream and then go do their work. Whereas the large molecules just have to be given straight into the bloodstream.
Now let's jump over to business. People much prefer pills than having to go and stick a needle into their arm and infuse these biopharmaceutical drugs slowly into your bloodstream. Why can't we just go and somehow make those into pills, find ways to make them smaller and put them in pills?
Yeah, people have tried that for about 20 years now, maybe a little bit longer. And the idea that we had, and this is how I actually started my career, was we'll just look at the way the protein therapeutic binds to its target, and we'll just view it as kind of a lost wax thing, you know, and we'll take the parts of it that interdigitate with its target, and we'll mimic those parts. And
we'll just take the little guys.
Yeah, we'll just throw away
the rest of this junk.
All this spinach that nature put on there, that's just nature just wasting time and energy, right?
Yeah.
You know, we know better than nature. So we tried that, and it turns out we don't know better than nature. There are a lot of things that we just didn't get right back in the 90s doing that. So mimicking the proteins turns out not to be a useful way to make smaller drugs out of larger ones.
But that didn't stop you. You want to make small pills, right?
We do. Yeah, we really do. And there are a couple of reasons. You mentioned one. It's much more convenient for patients and maybe a little bit safer to not have to get an infusion, you know, every month. The more interesting reason and the really exciting reason is that there are a lot of targets that live inside cells that simply can't be accessed by these biomolecules. And we know now, after 10, 15 years of really good genetics and genomics, a lot of those targets are super critical in processes like cell growth. So they're important targets for cancer. Where we don't want that cell to grow. Yeah. So they get stuck in some kind of on position, and we'd like to have a molecule that would turn it back off. So a lot of successful cancer therapeutics over the past 10 years have been biologics, these large molecules that are infused in the bloodstream, and they can do a wonderful job of shutting down processes that are out of control as long as those processes are happening outside the cell. But if they're happening inside the cell, there's no way for those biologics to get in. So you'd really like a small molecule that can penetrate the cell to get in and start shutting down some of those targets. And it's frustrating for people in the industry because we all know these are great targets. They just are behind this barrier we can't get to. So that's one of the main reasons we're working on the area of small molecules at DICE, is to get them into cells and really hit some targets that we think are going to make a big difference in patient lives.
I can't figure out whether this is just the Wild West where you're just looking at everything and trying to figure out how can we do this, but you know, you don't have any specific molecules, or you have some specific ideas and specific conditions. Which is it?
It's a little of both. It's a Wild West in the sense that we try not to bias our thinking going in. So we I think learned a lot, and we're humbled as a group. We learned some humility back in the 90s, right? We learned that, you know, things that are obvious to us really can't translate naturally into the settings we want them to translate to. So we can't just do a simple mimicry of nature. We have to be more open-minded. So when we construct our collections of molecules, we try and be as agnostic as we can be about what they look like physically, how they point out into space. So I always think of the center of a molecule as maybe living inside a sphere, and we want to display information around the edge of that sphere. We want to cover all the hemispheres, right? We don't want to leave any parts of that globe blank. And we just want to see what's going to fit into our target of interest without biasing ourselves by our own preconceived notions. All right. Now, having said that, we choose to make collections of molecules that live within certain size ranges. So we know going in, there are certain size ranges that are likely to penetrate cells. And remember, that's one of the main reasons we're doing all this. So we want to stay in a certain size range, you know, how much the molecule weighs. We don't want it to get too heavy. And so we'll bias those initial collections of compounds, which we call libraries, right? For the same reason that collections of books are libraries. There's a lot of information in there and you don't know which one you want. So we make these libraries of compounds, large collections of compounds. We bias them a little bit, but we try and go in there with as many solutions as we can. So maybe one way to think about it is, you know, one of the oldest concepts in the pharma industry is the lock and key theory, right? That there's going to be for every protein, you can think of it as a lock, and there's a site on the protein where a molecule could bind, and one and only one key or a molecule is going to fit into that site. We want to go in with a wide collection of possible keys that can fit into a wide variety of locks.
Now, how is what you're doing different from what Big Pharma does in developing small molecule drugs?
It has some similarities, but it's radically different in the core of what we're doing. So the similarities are we use the knowledge that Big Pharma and nowadays even small pharma has always used to develop small molecule drugs. We know what sizes roughly they need to be. We know certain features of the molecule you'd like to have and otherwise would like to avoid. So there are things that can, you know, cause trouble. You want to stay away from those. So we use the collected knowledge of the industry, but where DICE differs is that we're combining the power of biology to do things like evolution on an expedited scale. Some people call that directed evolution. So we're using directed evolution, but bringing that to chemistry for the first time. And that's what's really exciting. If you think about it, biologists have known for 20, 30 years how to evolve protein therapeutics, large molecules, to do just about anything they want. And that's relatively new. I mean, in the scheme of things, 20, 30 years is a long time, but in the history of our industry, it's pretty new. So now you have all this power if you're a biologist. If you want a large molecule, you can make anything you pretty much think of. It'll do this, it'll do that. And all you're doing is applying selective pressure, the way that Darwin first described, you know, for finches back in the Galapagos. What we're doing is that same process, but in a way that's going to yield small molecules. So we can evolve small molecules in the same way that until very recently you could only do it with proteins or large molecules. And that's what's really cool. That's what we're really excited about.
Kevin, some of this I don't totally understand, but I totally get that you're onto something here. Is that good enough?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good synopsis.
Is that a good synopsis?
Yeah,
you know, it's like you're not just getting, you know, huge libraries of compounds and throwing them at situations and see what binds. You're saying we're intelligently using how things develop, that mm-hmm. we're seeing how they develop. We know how they develop in the biologic area.
Yeah.
And now we're doing that in the chemistry area. In fact, you used to work for Genentech.
Correct.
So they were just as interested in this as anybody else.
Yeah. I mean, Genentech certainly has pioneered a lot of methodologies in the directed evolution of biologics. They've been really on the leading edge of that. And one of the things that they have really, I think, been the leader in the industry on for decades now is the production of monoclonal antibodies. So antibodies that can target any particular thing you want in the body, and those have turned out to be incredibly useful in cancer and oncology. So we, in the 90s, watched that happen at Genentech. It was a very impressive thing to watch, and it certainly left a big impression on me as a young scientist. And so in the back of my mind, I've always thought, well, gee, if you could do that with chemistry, that would be fantastic. But nobody ever had a way to do it with chemistry. So our founder is a guy by the name of Per Harbury, who's at Stanford, very bright guy, worked on this for 15 years and came up with a way to do it with chemistry. And so now you can do all the same tricks. So you can cross up the genes. You can essentially hybridize small molecules the same way you can hybridize, you know, plants or something. You want more optimal corn, you can hybridize.
Mix them up.
Mix them up. Rub the tassels together. So we can conceptually do the same thing with our molecules and allow the best ones to emerge from a very large collection, again, without preconceived notions, right? All you're asking for, I mean, in the corn analogy, all you want is big corn. You don't really care, you know, how that all happened. You're rubbing tassels together, and when the big ones come up, you just plant more of those.
Yeah.
Right? That's been done since people first walked out of caves, right? And we're just trying to bring that same level of thinking and agnosticism, which I think is really important. We don't, you know, I learned my lesson in the 90s, right? We thought we had it all
figured
out.
We were so smart.
Yeah, we'll just make this little widget and fit it in there and whir, you know, it's the sad trumpet thing. Wah, wah, wah. Like, that doesn't work, right? So now we've taken a lesson from nature and we're just saying, okay, we're going to run this process and we're going to wait for the right solutions to emerge. And after the fact, we can write all kinds of papers explaining how this all makes sense.
Right.
But it's the solutions we're interested in.
And I think there's also a great lesson here. It's like we know that today that no matter which of the sciences and engineering and all of this, all the big breakthroughs are coming when we cross these what are standard silos of science and engineering. And there's more to crossing those silos than we realized. And this is where all the new stuff emerges. And it sounds like that's where you guys are.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And there are a number of people involved with the company. So our founder, Per Harbury, our chief scientific officer is a guy by the name of Phil Patton. Those two gentlemen have trafficked at the intersection of chemistry and biology their whole careers. And I agree with you. That's where the really fertile stuff comes from, because things that are obvious to a chemist might be completely opaque to a biologist and vice versa. But if you get all those folks in a room together, some really magical things can happen. And that's, I think, what happened when Per invented this technology.
Well, come on back. See us again. We want to hear about the magic.
That's great. Thanks so much for having us.
Dr. Kevin Judice is the president and CEO of Dice Molecules. More information is available at dicemolecules.com. That's Dice, D-I-C-E, dicemolecules.com. We've all heard of shock, and that in any number of situations, people go into shock. I asked Dr. Thomas Hallam, the head of clinical development and regulatory affairs at Leading Biosciences, what is shock?
Shock is when the body experiences dangerously low blood pressure. Essentially, when the blood pressure drops too low, the body's tissues don't get enough blood supply. And this can happen through a number of different insults, right? If it's an infection, patient could get septic shock, or if it's a trauma, patient could bleed and have hemorrhagic shock. And when this low blood pressure occurs, basically certain parts of the body don't get adequate blood tissue. And we've discovered one of the critical components of shock is the blood flow to an area of the body called the mucosal barrier.
I didn't even know I had one, Tom.
Yeah.
Where is this?
We all have one. We have one that is this very thin layer in our small intestine. It separates the contents in our small intestine, the digestive enzymes, the bacteria, the food we ate for our last meal, and separates that from our intestine and our internal organs. And basically, we've discovered that that barrier is very sensitive to the oxygenation and the blood pressure. And for long periods of time, for a patient goes through a period of shock, there's not enough blood supply to that barrier, and it breaks down. And the enzymes then within the small intestine can leak out, and they can leak into the abdomen and actually begin to digest the patient's own organs from the inside out.
Well, I'm in shock about your description of shock.
Yeah.
That's just the way it goes. But what occurs to me is that shock is not just accidents. Like anytime you have an operation, I mean, there's any number of shocks to the body. Is it the same shock whenever we go through this?
So it's a great question. You can get into shock from any number of different possible entryways or insults, right? But what we found is at the end of the day, it's this low blood pressure is the triggering event that is really the driver of the breakdown of the mucosal barrier and the driver of the multi-organ failure that results from it.
So anytime you get this really low blood pressure situation for a sustained period of time, that's what we're looking at.
That's exactly right. Shock in particular is way more prevalent than most people thought. In fact, there's about 1.3 million cases of shock in the United States each year, with over 25% of those resulting in death. In fact, recently, there's been a number of celebrity deaths that have been reported to be from shock. In particular, Muhammad Ali's family released that his cause of death was actually septic shock from an infection and not from the Parkinson's that most people would associate with him. One of the things that I think is really important to know is that there's not a lot of treatments out there for shock. There's not a lot of things that you can do once someone goes into shock, except for kind of standard of care and kind of organ replacement therapy.
So you were saying there's not a lot we could do about shock.
Right. You know, if you look at historically over the last two decades, there have been a number of different treatments that have been tried to be developed for treating shock. And basically the last 65 clinical trials trying to develop new drugs or treatments for this have failed. And where we're at with Leading Biosciences is we have a new treatment we think that can stop the breakdown of the mucosal barrier and actually prevent these digestive enzymes from damaging the patient's organs and actually allow them to survive this period of shock and come out the other side and live.
So you're looking at a delay then, a delay just so it can finally just recover and you're out of the shock condition,
right,
if you will. Now, when do you administer this?
So if a patient goes into shock, basically, if they're conscious, they'd drink this. Otherwise, it'd be administered through a tube into their stomach. But most importantly, the critical factor is the drug has to be administered directly into their stomach or small intestine. That's where the drug needs to be because that's where those enzymes are that break down that barrier. And when we can get our drug directly there, we can show that we can stop those digestive enzymes and then stop the subsequent breakdown of tissue from the digestive enzymes.
So it's here, drink this.
Exactly.
Now here, that you have this devastating event that happened to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, this could be problematic. So delivery is a challenge for you.
It could be a challenge, but you know, we think about it like this. A lot of times that the drug can be used basically from the ICU to the field to the battlefield, right? Where if you have an event where someone could trigger an event of shock, patient can drink this on a prophylactic basis, right? Where patient, imagine you're a soldier on a battlefield, right? You get a wound that's bleeding, right? And the soldier then can mix this with their canteen water and drink it, right? And basically preserve that mucosal barrier and allow them to survive that period of time to where they can get adequate medical care.
I'm a little amazed at the numbers you have of people dying from shock. I don't recall shock as being, you know, the diagnosis or the cause of death.
This is a really great insight. If you look at someone, for example, that was in a severe car accident and had a bleeding episode, right? The death certificate will say, you know, motor vehicle accident. It doesn't say that, oh, the patient was actually, you know, fine. They went to the hospital and the emergency room, or for a while they missed the fact there was this internal bleeding and eventually they went through this period of shock. So it's usually there's usually a death certificate that says a cause of death is something above that level where you get to that final episode of shock that really can be the crisis for that patient.
So you've got to get in there and understand that in a certain set of circumstances, get ahead of the game here.
Get ahead of the game.
Now, where are you from compound to accept registered product? Where are you in that arc?
Great question. We are now at that point where we're actually in phase two clinical trials. So we're actually testing this in patients now in the United States, and we're going to get the data to prove whether or not this hypothesis is right. We actually can stop this process in the small intestine and preserve these patients' lives.
Do you hang out at emergency rooms? How are you doing this? How do you recruit people into this?
You know, believe it or not, that's almost what we do. We have the hospitals that enroll these clinical trials. They have monitors that are and alert systems to find these patients when they come into the hospitals so that they can treat them right away with their own procedures. And then we piggyback onto their own procedures.
They're not coming out of it. Maybe we can do this. Maybe this is an option.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, good luck to you. Tom, please come back and see us. We'd like to get updated on this story.
Great. Thank you so much, Myra.
Dr. Thomas Hallam is the head of clinical development and regulatory affairs at Leading Biosciences. More information is available at leadingbiosciences.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment, Biotech Nation, are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.